This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Test your mics. Test the mics.
Mortal Kombat!
I may have said it before, so don't think of this as me plagiarizing myself so much as dropping another quarter in for a replay, but drop your coins and gird your loins, folks, because it's time for Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com!
It's time to test your might.
Dun, 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 dun. That's never going to get old. That's never, ever, 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 ever going to get old.
It's never going to get old. It can't get old. It's a movie built around a song that they love so much they play it every chance they get.
Oh, we are going to get into this. Guys, this is the Weekly Cult, an exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me as per usual, Lieutenant of Megaforce himself, screenwriter on Marvel's Doctor Strange, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Test your might.
Dum 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 dum. I think we probably listened to that song like 20 times in preparation for this show. And by that I mean we watched the movie in preparation for this show, which
yes.
plays the song about 20 times.
Yeah, that is one of the hallmarks of this movie. Honestly, this is a movie I'm kind of shocked we haven't covered yet.
And we will cover it in just a moment, but first we have to plug our shit. Dun, 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 dun. If you would like to hear more of this type of rambling, you can check out our back cataloged episodes on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. I have been doing a lot more recently to kind of clue people in on what movies we're doing. I have never seen a reaction. By the way, you guys are awesome. I have never seen a reaction like when I post. All I posted was the logo for this movie. And I think I said, like, it has begun or something, and people went apeshit that we were covering this movie.
In other words, we love you fucking guys.
Clearly a fan favorite film, one that we are right there with you guys. We are going to talk about 1995's
Mortal Kombat!
Oh, yes.
You knew
so
we
excited.
Had to do that.
So excited. So, Cargill, before we get into the discussion about Mortal Kombat itself, I have to ask you a question. Why is it that it seems impossible to make a good movie based on a video game?
Well, you know, this is actually, you know, honestly, this is something we wrestled with when Scott and I were working on Deus Ex, which is a script we're still very
Deus
proud
Ex,
of.
Deus Ex, Deus Ex. No?
You, okay. You laugh. On the way home from recording last week, I hop in my car and Amadeus was on. And for some reason, every time Amadeus popped into my head over the last week, I thought about being here at your place and for you to like go to Amadeus.
Because you know that I'm one of the few people in your life who knows the difference between Taco and Falco.
That is true. One did Putting on the Ritz and the other did Amadeus.
Yes, and one of them is dead. Which one?
Which one? That's everyone goes to Google. We're not telling. We're not telling. Google it yourself.
Wiki that shit, motherfuckers.
But the thing is that, you know, especially back in the day, you know, I did a famous rant on this on Spill back in the day, and it held true then. It does not hold true now. But, you know, computing power was so limited that games were only able to do certain things. You know, there was only a certain amount you could put in any given game. You had RAM limitations, you had CPU limitations, you had programming code limitations.
Oh my god, I just fell asleep. No, I'm sorry. Tell me more about your RAM codes.
What what that led to was that video games had to, you know, fill that space as best they could with pure action and what would keep you dropping coins in. Mm-hmm. And so the story was limited. When we had these fighting games, when these fighting games became really popular, the only story you would get is maybe at the beginning of the game in a quick opening screen, and then you'd get the full character storyline when you actually beat the game. And that was like the big prize for beating the game, was you'd get a few paragraphs of why they were doing it and maybe get a few small little cut animations. So these games were really thin. They were about concepts. They were about things to do with your hands and engage and to engage your imagination. They weren't about telling stories.
Right.
And then as computer games, as computing power increased, the game style didn't really change for a while. It was still about engaging that imagination, but stories were still thin and weak. Mm-hmm. And then as gamers matured and as they grew up, and an entire generation who'd grown up on video games said, we still love video games, but we want more, then stories became important and hiring talented writers became important. And all of a sudden we started getting video games that had real genuine arcs and storylines and changeable arcs and storylines, to where you'd have functionally different endings to games if you didn't do everything the same way. And so you ended up getting to an era where you ended up with games like Deus Ex, which were really great stories. They were great games, but the stories themselves are what drove it, not just the gameplay. And so we're just now getting into an era where you can really adapt these popular games and be true to the story. But with Mortal Kombat, it was a game about putting a bunch of really cool looking characters together and fighting in bizarre locations and beating the crap out of each other, until you got to the point where you beat the boss, and then you're like, oh, here's why I was fighting in the tournament the whole time. And you'd be like, fuck yeah, that's the perfect reason why I was beating the crap out of these characters. But for the bulk of the game, it would just be, ready, fight, and or test your might. And then
you proceed to mash the fuck out of the buttons.
You'd mash the fuck out of the buttons. You would win, and then it would show you going to a different location to fight someone else. And once you went through the entire roster, then you got to the bosses, and once you beat all the bosses, then you got your cutscene. And how do you make a movie out of that? I mean, it's, one of the famously worst video game movies of all time is Super Mario Brothers, which we talked about previously on the Bob Hoskins episode when we sadly lost him. How do you take a game that's about a guy running through a cartoon world, hitting bricks with his fucking head, and turn that into a 2-hour movie? How do you do it? Well, they couldn't.
Yeah.
Mortal Kombat stands as a testament to the one and only time someone made a really entertaining video game movie, because someone came in and said, okay, here's the base concept of this. How do we build something around it? It's what went wrong with Street Fighter 2. Like, Street Fighter 2 Legend of Chun-Li is the worst part about that movie. There's so many things wrong with that movie, so many things hilariously wrong with that movie. But the worst thing about the movie is, how do you take a game about a video game tournament and turn it into a movie that doesn't have a fighting tournament? Like, how do you do, like, there's no street fighting in Street Fighter. But in Mortal Kombat, holy fuck, is there a lot of Mortal Kombat.
And that's the thing we're definitely going to talk about today. And I feel like the big disclaimer that we have to throw in at the very beginning of the show is that in the grand celebrated tradition of video game movie adaptations, we are not talking about a good movie today.
No.
We are talking about a movie that we recognize that on so many measurable levels is not quality filmmaking. However, definitely the most entertaining of the lot. And I say that as someone who kind of unabashedly loves the movie Street Fighter. And again, recognize all of its flaws. Oh. I see them from space.
Wait, Street Fighter or Street Fighter 2 Legend of Chun-Li?
No, Street Fighter, because I'm not an idiot.
I love Street Fighter 2 Legend of Chun-Li, but not because it's good.
Okay, well, fair enough. But today we are talking about Mortal Kombat, which is directed...
Mortal Kombat!
Which is directed by Paul W.S. Anderson.
No. It's directed by Paul Anderson.
According to the credits.
This is before he added the WS.
However he wants to break down the initials of his name, Paul W.S. Anderson is the rich man's Uwe Boll. He is the guy who has also made a career out of adapting a lot of video games. This is not the only one he's adapted. And yet, this is a situation where he made the single most entertaining video game to movie adaptation of all time. And Mortal Kombat...
By the way, just to point this out, any of you out there going, fuck you, man, Resident Evil is the best one. Also, Paul W.S. Anderson.
That's what I'm saying. Paul W.S. Anderson did not just dabble in one video game to movie.
He dabbles
adaptation.
In making the most entertaining video game movies of all time, but for my money, this is best.
I will. Are you kidding me? I will watch Mortal Kombat any day of the week before I'll revisit the first Resident Evil. Absolutely. And they both. There's a lot that they have in common. They both have terrible CGI.
Oh. Oh. Yeah, but let's hold on. But let's be fair to Resident Evil. Resident Evil is far and away. Much,
7 years later, still haven't figured out how to use CGI.
It's still a lot better than what's in this movie. This movie is the only reason this movie doesn't have some of the worst CGI ever made is because there was a sequel called Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
Oh my God.
That made this look like fucking Casablanca.
I almost said that we shouldn't even mention Annihilation.
How can you not mention Annihilation?
You can't not mention Annihilation.
Annihilation has one of my favorite anecdotes of all time, in which I went to see this movie with my wife on opening night, and I walk up and go to buy the tickets, and I'm like, two for Mortal Kombat Annihilation. And the guy looks at me, he's like, seriously? And I'm like, well, yeah. And he's like, okay, I guess we'll run it after all. And I'm like, so is it any good? And he goes, frankly, a team of monkeys could have written a better script. And I watched it, and it was like, wow, I agree with this guy.
And then a young
Holy
Marco said,
shit.
I could be that monkey. And here we are today.
Monkey.
And here we are today. So the basic premise, if you've never played a single round of Mortal Kombat, if you've never put one quarter into an arcade cabinet, if you weren't the kid on the block with a Sega Genesis,
then you didn't live in the 90s, for one thing.
Then you really didn't live in the 90s.
And you probably haven't played NBA Jam, and you haven't probably played fucking Street Fighter.
Yeah. There were
Tekken.
Yeah, come on, man.
God damn you people.
There were the things that made this video game different from the others were actually it was twofold. One, it was extremely violent. I mean, this is the first game that really revels in graphic violence. The first fight, even like there had been other fighting games, but this one really just pushes the envelope in all of the best worst ways and actually is the game that caused video games to be rated from that point forward, because there was such an outrage from parents that their kids were ripping people's skulls out with the spine still attached, or like, you know, slicing their heads off or ripping their hearts out.
Well, that was what was
the
interesting point of this game. Every single one of these fighting games that were big in the 90s, mm-hmm. each had their own gimmick. Street Fighter had the best the best controls. It was six buttons, not four. There was so much variety in the movement you could do. Tekken had unlockable characters, so when you beat the game and did a number of people beat the game in different ways, you'd unlock new characters, and there were constantly new characters coming in, so you'd constantly go back to see if anyone had locked new characters. Of course, we didn't have the internet at this point, so there was no way to know what all the characters were. Just randomly new characters would show up, new costumes would show up. It would be crazy. But what was so attractive about Mortal Kombat was you could finish your opponents, and you could do so in really bloody fucking ways.
Yeah, and it actually rewarded you for learning different combinations of buttons that, you know, if you got that famous finish him command and you could execute those combinations of buttons, you would enact upon your opponent horrendous violence, just like the things that would, you know, make you grimace, except that you were a child, and so you were like, oh my God, that was awesome, and your parents would freak out. And it, again, it's the reason why there are ratings on games to this day. It was the game that caused enough outrage that, yep, I believe it was Tipper Gore, wasn't it, who kind of led the charge?
Well, yeah, Tipper Gore was the one leading the charge on all this stuff in the 80s and 90s. She was the one who got labels on records and went after 2 Live Crew and rappers in the late 80s. Then turned her ire on video games, because video games are corrupting the youth.
Yeah. And then the other thing that made Mortal Kombat so different is that it used, for its characters, digitized sprites. So instead of like, in playing Street Fighter, all those characters look very drawn. They look very much like cartoons.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, these characters, who are really just beating the shit out of each other and ripping each other's limbs off and disemboweling each other, the to add on to that, look like real people doing it.
It looks like real life.
Yeah.
Like, these graphics were so amazing. Like, you look at it now and it's comical, but at the time,
it blew our minds.
The first time I walked into an arcade and saw Mortal Kombat, I was like, what the fuck is this? It's one of those that they used to put TVs on top of the cabinets, because at first so many people would be watching this game that you couldn't crowd around the cabinet. So they would plug in TVs on top so you could stand back with the crowd and watch the game. And you would do that.
And so the basic premise of the movie, the basic premise of the game is, fight until you're dead. Like, fight until you've beaten every other opponent and moved up this giant ladder, or you die. That's it. That was the premise of the game. There was a storyline to go behind it, to go with it, but you kind of had to dig deep into the game to even find it. It really didn't matter. It was just beat anyone who is in front of you, keep beating them until your quarters run out. The movie plot is that three martial artists from very different walks of life, Liu Kang, Johnny Cage, and Sonya Blade, are summoned to an island to compete in a tournament that is orchestrated by a sorcerer named Shang Tsung, and the outcome of that tournament will decide the fate of the universe.
Three strangers will travel to the mystical realm of Outworld to defend our people against Shang Tsung.
You will die.
And his forces of darkness in an ancient tournament. One more victory.
Your soul is mine.
And our world
is
theirs.
It has begun.
The fate of your world.
I feel like the problem with, and we've touched on it a little bit, the problem with trying to make a movie out of a video game is you have one of two problems. And both of them have to do with extrapolation. One is that you try to stay very faithful to a game with a very thin premise, and the result is you don't really have a movie. You have something that's very weak. You have something that's not interesting to watch, because in attempting to faithfully adapt that game, you have uncovered how minimalist the story of the game is. As Cargill was talking about, a lot of these early games didn't have much story. The reverse problem is that you realize that going in, and you try to add so much to it that you add these absurd elements that have literally nothing to do with the game and make it a completely different movie, much in the case of Super Mario Brothers, where they tried to make it Blade Runner. And I was like, I don't understand what you're going for, guys. It's just, this really doesn't work. That's too much. And you start losing elements of the game to where it's just a generic bad movie that isn't really pulling in fans of the game. I feel like Mortal Kombat, if you look at those two problems on a continuum, Mortal Kombat is the one that most effectively walks that line and flirts with both of those issues and lands in a territory that is just entertaining enough to make us forgive a lot of its problems. But what's crazy about it to me is that the thing about Mortal Kombat that a lot of people don't know is that the game was originally intended to be a game starring Jean-Claude Van Damme. The whole game was built around Jean-Claude Van Damme, but then that idea fell through, so then they turned it into a fighting game. But if you look at the character of Johnny Cage in Mortal Kombat, he's a movie star, martial artist, who looks an awful lot like Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Little bit.
So if you think about Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, especially his early movies, Cargill, what is one thing that appears over and over and over again in his early movies?
Well, first of all, to say only one thing occurs over and over again, those movies are all fucking identical.
Okay, but what is
like
the
beat
one central...
Beat for beat identical.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at.
What are you talking about?
What's the central element of every single one of those early movies?
His brother or friend gets killed and he needs to get revenge.
By...
An evil...
No. Get revenge by competing in...
In a tournament.
A tournament! All of his fucking early movies are built around tournaments. So the easiest thing to do, I feel, would have been to just make Bloodsport with the Mortal Kombat characters. Because A, you are paying tribute to the spirit of the game in the first place, which was that it was supposed to be a game about Jean-Claude Van Damme. And two... It's a tournament. That's exactly what you move people up. They get beaten. They get knocked off. That's what the fucking game was. But Paul W.S. Anderson didn't make Bloodsport. He made Enter the Dragon.
Yeah.
This movie's plot is identical to fucking Enter the Dragon.
Yeah.
You have three martial artists, very much like the three martial artists in Enter the Dragon, one of whom is getting revenge for a sibling that has been killed by the evil leader of the tournament, who all get on a boat and go to an island to compete in a tournament where the rules don't really seem to matter that much. It's really just about the evil guy pushing his agenda.
I disagree. The rules matter. The problem is they never establish the rules until the plot needs a rule.
See, but they add so much pomp and circumstance to the, like, oh, well, now I'm enacting my right to challenge anyone. And it's like, okay, I guess we'll go with you on
that.
Well,
they did. That's the actual one rule they set up early.
But then immediately later on, it's like, I'm not going to fight her because Kitana says I can't. No explanation as to why suddenly that was the one rule that everybody had to follow. But Kitana says, no, you can't do that. So he says, okay, I fight Johnny Cage. And then Liu Kang says, no, you'll fight me. There are no fucking rules.
There's no fucking rules.
There are no fucking rules. And they're all talking about the sacred rules of Mortal Kombat. They literally call it that at one point. There are no fucking rules to this tournament at all. And in fact, they could have simplified it so much more by just showing us, like, people move, like very much like Bloodsport, or fuck it, Over the Goddamn Top does a better job of explaining.
Here
the
we
top.
Go.
I'm telling you, does a better job of explaining who's moving up in the rankings, who's getting knocked off, and how that, like,
this. Because Over the Top is amazing.
But what I'm saying
it's not fair to compare this to Over
there's
the Top.
Literally a fucking chart on the wall in Bloodsport that tells us who's fighting who, who's moving up, who's been eliminated. Montages explain all of the fighters that have been knocked off. That does not happen in Mortal Kombat. People are fighting at random intervals in random places against random opponents.
And then there is a montage of like 80 guys being thrown into the rocks.
But who's beating them?
You assume Goro?
So Goro's, like, so while everyone else has had one fight apiece, Goro's had to fight, what was it, a battle royale? Did they
We have no idea.
This is the shit I'm talking about. It's way, like, in structure, just way too complicated. If they had just made this a movie that was legitimately a tournament, I feel like they could have saved themselves so much bullshit exposition that then they throw out the window the minute it's not convenient anymore.
Yeah, but you know what? It's a lot of fun.
It's so much fun! I don't want to like this movie. I really don't. Because,
yeah, you do.
Because the critical part of me sitting there going, that's fucking stupid. Why would you? But then,
see, the thing is literally when you are adapting a game like this, a game that is extraordinarily visceral, a game that is built around its visuals rather than story, you have to hit that sweet spot of giving the audience at the time, a bunch of teenagers and young 20-somethings, exactly what the fuck they want, and at the same time, entertaining them and keeping the movie moving. And this movie does that expertly. You know, there are times
it does it on expert mode.
There are times where dialogue just is like, oh God. There are times where
I'm going to call them sound bites. Not even going to call it dialogue. Just a bunch of sound bites.
Sometimes. And then there's shit that, you know, that happens inexplicably that you're just like, all right, that's just for entertainment value. Like when, you know, in the end, when Shang Tsung takes Sonya Blade into
Outworld.
All of a sudden, she's dressed like a fucking cheerleader. Like she's
a cheerleader
wearing,
in a White Snake video.
Yeah, and it's not even that they put her in some ceremonial garb. They teased her hair to look like it's still the fucking 80s. Like it's just like, what is going on here? I have no idea what this sequence is about. But fuck it, because it's fucking Mortal Kombat. And every time you think, oh God, this movie, why am I watching this? All of a sudden, somebody walks into the room, they get into a fight, and you hear, Mortal Kombat! And you're like, yeah, fuck yeah, that's why I'm watching this movie.
I think it is important to note that Sonya is Shang Tsung's cherry pie, which is why she has that haircut in the end of the movie. But yeah, let's talk for a second about that music, because It is the fucking lifeblood of this movie.
Well, the music is the whole lifeblood of this movie. I mean, this album was really fucking awesome when it came out.
Triple fucking platinum,
guys. It was a good album. I mean, it was, you know, there's KMFDM, Gravity Kills, George S. Clinton. There's a whole bunch of folks on that album, and those songs were just so freaking cool. Tracy Lords did a track. Orbital did a track back before Orbital became, most people knew who Orbital was.
Wait. George S. Clinton?
Yeah.
Isn't that the guy who was the lyricist for the movie The Apple? I think there is a George Clinton who was the funk master, and then there was a George S. Clinton who was the lyricist for the movie Apple. Yeah. So either way, kind of amazing kind that he's on the soundtrack.
Fear Factory, Sister Machine Gun, Typo Negative. I mean, this album was fucking tight. It was awesome. Yeah. And then it had that song. And believe it or not, those of you maybe too young, those listening maybe too young to remember, this was a song that was legitimately played on the radio. It had legitimate, the alternative station was playing the Mortal Kombat theme song. Yeah. It was, you'd hear it, and, like, it was crazy. It was totally bonkers, and it makes this movie. All the fight scenes have all this great music, but at the same time, with the shooting style that Paul W.S. Anderson had adopted for this, and the visual effects, which fall flat so many times, and this soundtrack, this is easily in my top five of most 90s films ever.
Oh, for sure.
Like, some movies are timeless. Other movies could not have been made in any other era and could not be mistaken for anything else. And this is that fucking movie. It is just so unspeakably 90s.
It's so
90s. Best way.
It's so 90s that one of the ninjas in the background in one of the shots, I shit you not, is wearing flannel. I'm not kidding. That's not a joke, guys. That's for real. The scene where Goro is fighting Johnny Cage, if you watch, one of the ninjas is wearing a fucking flannel shirt.
Probably because he forgot to take it off between takes.
Probably. But yeah, that music, you know, it didn't just, the music is the greatest sorcerer of the whole movie. The soundtrack is the greatest sorcerer, even more so than Shang Tsung, because it convinces you that every fight you're watching is incredible. If you took the music out of these fight sequences, I actually think they're pretty good, but there's a lot.
They're not great.
They're not great, and there's this weird thing where I feel like the filmmakers don't trust their own fight sequences because they slow things down all the time that do not need to be slowed down. In fact, would be far more impressive if they were just, because it's clear they're not slowing them down because the stunt people aren't actually executing these moves. They're being executed. So I feel like they would have been more impressive if we could have seen them at normal speed.
Well, yeah, but keep in mind that this movie's 95. This movie happened.
This movie is 95 years old, guys. No, it was 1995. Got it.
This movie happened just before the Hong Kong invasion. Like, the Hong Kong invasion happened shortly after this. This was the period of time where movie geeks were going to Hong Kong video stores and Vietnamese video stores and getting bootlegged imports on VHS of stuff, which literally what they were doing was importing the VHS's copy. I forget which format they used over in the East at the time, but they would then copy them over onto VHS. And they were such bad transfers that if there was too much dialogue, you'd have the beginning and the end of the sentences cut off. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we were just then discovering this whole world of awesome martial arts film that was happening, this revolution over in Hong Kong. And these guys hadn't come over yet. So we were still, this is the last days of the Jean-Claude Van Damme, Steven Seagal style. Yeah, let me show the same kick to the head four times in a row from four different angles, kind of martial arts. And so it seems really unimpressive after the invasion happened, because when you watch Rumble from the Bronx for the first time, you're like, holy fuck, that's what fighting is.
Yeah.
Like, that's not what you see here. So it was like when we first got Jackie Chan films on the big screen over here, it was mind blowing because this was the best we had up until this point.
Yeah. And so not only does the music accomplish the goal of convincing the audience that every fight sequence is super badass, even when there are times when they are incredibly lame, they also convinced us as kids that our high school pep rallies were amazing. and that our and that every time our basketball team played, it was an epic event. Seriously, go to you could not go, you still can't go to fucking high school games without hearing at least one song off the goddamn Mortal Kombat soundtrack. Yeah. It's still it carries on to this day, the grand tradition of making things seem cooler than they are, which was, I feel like, what they were going for in the first place and why the album went triple platinum.
And why every time there's a major fight scene, they play it.
And thank God that the filmmakers of Mortal Kombat said, you know who's not getting enough love are martial arts movies fans who also have anterograde amnesia, who every 5 minutes are going to forget what this movie is called. Let's have the soundtrack scream the name of the movie at them pretty much every 5 minutes, because that's what happens. And you gotta hand it to a movie bold enough to remind you every step of the way what the name of that movie is. Guys, this was before digital cable and the menu screens you could just pull up with the push of a button to remind you what you're watching. If you're like Leonard from Memento and you forgot to tattoo Mortal Kombat on your wrist, and halfway in you're like, I don't even know what I'm watching anymore, fear not, because at any given point the music's going to step in and remind you that it's Mortal Kombat!
Yeah, well, keep in mind, again, 1999, you had two choices when you turned something on and you didn't know what it was. You could go and pull up the paper book.
TV guide.
The TV guide, or the if you were poor like my family, the TV guide that came in the newspaper, and scan through and find out what channel you were on and look that up. Or you could go, if you had fancy cable, you could go to channel 99, which would have the complete listing of what was playing right now, scrolling at a snail's pace. And if you blinked, you missed the channel and had to wait for it to loop back again.
Oh, so annoying.
90s so nostalgia.
So I got to ask you this, Cargill. What is your relationship? I know you and I are of different ages, but what is your relationship with the first Mortal Kombat game?
Well, I mean, like what I was talking about early on in the episode, I mean, I was one of those children of arcades. You know, arcades first started being a thing when I was very young. And I grew up on Air Force bases. I'm a military brat. And every Air Force base, you know, has everything that that young men would be interested in having that is morally acceptable on base, so you don't have to go anywhere. So you would have a liquor store on base. You'd have a convenience store on base. You'd have a video store on base. And you would also have an arcade. So I always grew up with an arcade that my parents were fine with me walking to, and they'd give me $5 and I'd go to the arcade and I'd play a bunch of video games. And so, of course, by the time I was a teenager and arcades were the thing, you know, especially in San Antonio, where I spent my teen years, we had Diversions. And Diversions was where, if you were a teenager in San Antonio, you either went there or you went to Lucky J's. And Lucky J's was the pool hall slash arcade, and Diversions was the straight up arcade. And Diversions always had the brand new games and was just this amazing wonderland. And I remember the first time, I mean, I was a big Street Fighter II fan. Street Fighter II is my jam. I'm a Chun-Li player through and through. Occasionally Guile, but mostly Chun-Li. But the first time I walked in and saw Mortal Kombat, I'm like, what the happy horseshit is this? And it just looked so amazing. And it was, and I never was madly in love with it. But when the Genesis came out and Mortal Kombat came out for the Genesis, that was the reason I owned the Genesis, because it was one of the very first video games that looked exactly like the arcade. Super Mario Brothers looked exactly like the arcade, but the arcade version really came after the portable version. Like, it wasn't a port over, it was, we made this for the Nintendo and we've made a box that has a Nintendo in it that's playing this game, so you can play it at the arcade so we can make money that way. But this it was like, holy shit, this is the real deal. And so I spent hours and hours in my first apartment playing Mortal Kombat with my buddies, and you know, you just kick back and drink and play Mortal Kombat for hours, on my TV sitting on a floor because we couldn't afford a TV stand, on my carpet in my first apartment, me and my buddies just sitting around playing Mortal Kombat. So of course I have a strong nostalgic attachment to it. And of course, the day Mortal Kombat came out, me and all my buddies were there, you know, a Friday afternoon screening, 3:30 in the afternoon, and we just lost our fucking minds.
Well, that's crazy. This is, it's not often that you and I have very similar nostalgias for something, but yeah, I remember Sega Genesis being the second big system that we got after the NES, and my parents are actually very young, so when that came out, my mom was very disinterested in video games, which is probably why we were allowed to play it. I don't think she paid a lot of attention because she just wasn't interested in video games. But my dad not only like encouraged us to play, but played with us and was actually the guy that we would get to help us beat levels we couldn't beat, my brother and I. I remember watching my dad beat the whole game with Kano. Kano was his character. And it just, that whole...
Really?
Yeah, Kano was his favorite character. He learned how to do the heart rip, and he would do it every time. We thought it was so fucking awesome. And so yeah, I remember watching, like, playing this game with my brother and then watching my dad play it and just having so much fun and enjoying it and never like reveling in the violence, like never being like, yeah, fucking rip the guy's heart out. It was just like, it was cool to see that my dad could play the same games that my friends and I could play. You know, it was just cool to see that he could do the same thing.
Those animations were cool. And yeah, don't get me wrong, they were part of the attraction of the game. But the thing that really attracted everybody was it actually took knowing the combinations and getting your timing right to get it to work. You could not, it was not something that just you did every time, because if you could do it every time, you were a fucking badass.
Right, absolutely. So yeah, when this movie came out, I was all of like 11 years old. So I was super excited for it. And I remember loving the shit out of this movie when I was a kid, just because it was everything I wanted it to be. And one of the reasons I will tip my hat to this movie is I feel like a lot of who the characters were in the game comes through in how they're portrayed in the movie. And I think a lot of that, and I know this is crazy to say in a video game based movie, is due to the performances.
Yeah.
There's some really strong performances in this movie.
Well, yeah, everybody looks cool in this movie.
Yes.
Like, in fact, the biggest chumps in the movie are the two coolest characters in the game.
Yes.
Like, that's the thing, is this movie took the characters that were like, that character. But Scorpion and Sub-Zero were the fucking greatest characters in that game. And in this movie, they are chump-tastic. And it's because they weren't allowed to be anything more than the extension of their video game.
Yeah.
In this, while it's thin, while it is at times shoddily written, you don't have a question about anyone's motivation in this.
No.
You know why everybody's doing everything, and you're fine with it, and you go along with it. Even the bad guys, you get their fucking motivations. And that's sometimes the hardest thing to get, but you get why Kano's on this island. You know, you get why Shang Tsung is doing what he's doing, why Goro's doing what he's doing. But it's like, well, why are... Oh, because they're my zombie thralls. Yeah, that's just it.
Yeah.
And they're, I thought Sub-Zero would be cooler. I thought Scorpion would be cooler.
It is weird that all... I think I said this to you while we were watching it, and like all of the minions of Shang Tsung kind of go out like punks. In that, like, Goro gets punched in the balls and then thrown off a cliff. Goro, who throughout the movie has been built up to be the ultimate badass, and we watch the result of him fighting, all these people getting thrown on the ground, he's killing people left and right, and then Johnny Cage just punches him in the balls.
And then runs away. And then Goro follows him, and he knocks him off a cliff.
Yeah, and then, you know, Sub-Zero's beaten by the element which brings life. It's like, just say water. If you're going to give us a clue that's so ham-fisted and obvious, just say, throw water at him, stupid.
Katana exists just to show up and give little tiny bits of information.
The way the movie is structured, Raiden should really be the one giving.
Yeah.
But he's not at all. So they just let Katana do all of the actual mentoring.
Here's my theory on this.
Okay.
My theory on this is that a lot of the things that happen in this movie reference Mortal Kombat 2, the video game.
Yes, they do. There's a scene where Johnny Cage's picture after he beats Scorpion, it says, "To my biggest fan," which is his friendship, which I believe didn't occur until the second one.
Katana's only in the second
one.
Reptile's only in the second one. Jax is only in the second one. Most of these elements are added as if they're afterthoughts. Mm-hmm. Like, none of these none of the characters or elements from the second game play a major part in the story.
No.
So I'm of the opinion that maybe they were working on the first Mortal Kombat movie when it was when Mortal Kombat became a big thing. Takes time to get this stuff done. And somewhere along the lines, late in the scripting or early in pre-production, they get access to the second video game, or the video game comes out and is huge, and people are like, oh shit, we've got to put this in here. Well, what if we make her partner at the beginning Jax? And what if we take all these scenes where Raiden shows up and gives them information and we make that Katana? What if this thing we've got, you know, this element of being followed around and spied upon is actually Reptile doing it, and we'll have a fight with Reptile at the end in Outland. Mm-hmm. I feel like all this stuff could have been added after the fact to kind of shoehorn these characters in. I think you're right. I think Raiden, that stuff was supposed to be Raiden overseeing it, because Raiden vanishes.
Yeah.
Like, Raiden can totally be there.
He's not allowed to go for reasons that are not explained at all.
Well, he's the god of this world,
but
he's
so
the protector of this realm.
But there are, but like the emperor is the emperor of Outworld, but the end of this movie is in our world inexplicably, even though they've won, which, by the way, is not satisfyingly explained in Annihilation.
Nothing is satisfying about Annihilation.
No.
Like Annihilation is a film where you took Christopher Lambert and replaced him with James Remar and hoped we wouldn't notice.
It's a movie where, despite the fact that this film made hundreds of millions of dollars and was massively successful, 75% of the cast could not be convinced to come back for it. Because it's a different Johnny Cage, it's a different Sonya Blade, it's a different Raiden. Like, the only people who come back are Katana and Robin Shu, who plays Liu Kang. Everybody else has been replaced.
Yeah, yeah. It's
we're good.
Yeah, that movie. That movie is unwatchable.
One of the few times in your life you're like, oh man, I wish Paul W.S. Anderson was here to direct this instead.
Oh yeah, no. The thing is, say what you will about Anderson, even his shittiest movies are kind of entertaining.
That's true.
I mean, like, of his misfires are so terrible that you can't stop. Like Three Musketeers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, his Three Musketeers is so bad. It's so bad. But man, is it fucking watchable. You just kind of howl with laughter the whole time. But not Annihilation. Annihilation is just like, ugh. But here,
Annihilation is not his. So
no, I know.
Yeah, okay,
I know. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I really wish he had done that. This movie gives you kind of everything you're asking for.
I just want to point this out as something you said. I think you're on the right track here, because Mortal Kombat 2 had already been out by the time the movie came out. In fact, they did something with the release of this movie that is like kind of a foreshadowing to the way Marvel, Disney, Marvel, Star Wars does things now, in that it was a full onslaught of marketing for the film. So the movie was released in August of 95. Then a digital TV special came out at the end of August of that year. And then a tour arrived at Radio City Music Hall in September. I'm guessing a tour of the people featured on the soundtrack. And then a CD-ROM came out in October, and Mortal Kombat 3 came out in October as well. So it was like, within a couple of months, Mortal Kombat was fucking everywhere.
Oh, yeah. No.
Mortal Kombat 3, though, was the game that came out a month after the movie came out.
Yeah. But my theory is that probably what happened was they had worked on the script before the second one came out.
Yeah, that's
possible. Then we're adding elements to try to work the second game in, because they were like, shit, people are going to be pissed if these characters don't show up.
I have an alternate theory about why Katana is here, and I just realized that I've kind of explained it earlier on. You remember in the movie Enter the Dragon, there is a character on the island who is pretending to be one of the prostitutes,
yeah,
who's actually another agent and helps Bruce Lee accomplish his goals. I think in their quest to basically make the most plagiarized version of Enter the Dragon ever, they were like, oh, wait, that character. We don't have, like, the only female character we have is Sonya, and she's one of the combatants. What do we do? Well, there's another female character in the second Mortal Kombat. Great, bring her on. And I think that's why, and again, as an afterthought, and I think that's why a lot of Raiden's guidance is marginalized because it's like, no, we have to structure this more like Enter the Dragon because that's the only way this makes sense to us. Which, again, I just don't understand why they didn't do Bloodsport, but that's the way they went.
So I want to bring something up.
Bring it up.
There's one core issue I have with this movie.
Okay.
Shang Tsung has the worst superpower I've ever seen.
Okay. Now, in the movie, they talk about he is claiming people's souls. Your soul is mine. By the way, the one of the two best performances in the movie, I talked a little bit about how there are great performances in this, is by Kari Hiroyuki Tagawa, who is already a JFC alum because he's the head of the Pirates of the Sang Brotherhood in The Phantom.
Oh, yeah.
And he's amazing.
Yes.
But he plays Shang Tsung.
Yes.
He's telling people, your soul is mine.
Yes, and he takes the souls. So battling Shang Tsung is like battling the souls of 1,000 other combatants.
Yes, because everybody wants their Mortal Kombat movie to resemble, you know, Joe Estevez's Soul Taker.
So. Or Christopher Lambert in Highlander.
Who is Raiden and is awesome in this movie.
Okay, so here's my real problem with it. Shang Tsung only collects the soul of losers.
Right.
Like, his superpower is he gets to take the souls of people who got the shit kicked out of them. It's kind of like having a magical fedora that gives you the power of an intellect of 1,000 other guys wearing fedoras. Like, it's like, you. It's, you know, it's.
I thought you were going to say it's like having Indiana Jones's fedora that gives you all of his powers, but then you put it on, you're like, oh shit, I'm Shia LaBeouf.
Oh shit, all of a sudden I can argue with you for hours about how vaping isn't bad for you. Let me explain to you, m'lady, why video games aren't misogynistic. Let me tip my hat to you, sir. Good day, sir, m'lady. It's like he's cut the souls and the powers and the combat knowledge of 1,000 people who got their ass kicked. Like, yeah. It's like that. No wonder he gets his ass kicked. That's where he draws his power from.
Yeah.
His power is from the losers. You don't do that. You take the souls of the winners, not the people who have lost. Cause it's not like, oh, you have lost. Now I can claim your soul. There's no rule about that. He just goes and goes. It's more like, hey, you won. I'm taking your soul. That's not fair. Read the rules.
Read the rules that I will change at a moment's notice just for the fuck of it.
Yeah.
But I want to say this. The way that's applied in the sequels to the Mortal Kombat game is awesome because you can, when you play as Shang Tsung, do different button combinations and transform into other fighters from the game, and then you instantly have all of their powers as well, all their moves, and it's awesome. It's such a great, innovative concept.
Oh, yes.
But that's not the way it's applied in the movie.
Oh, no. In the movie, he just occasionally turns into other actors.
He bitches out.
No.
In the movie, when he's in a fight and uses his power, he just summons an army of other people to fight for him, which makes him kind of like...
Who get their asses handed to them very quickly because they were a bunch of fucking losers.
Yeah. And honestly, like, it makes him more like Shredder from the Ninja Turtle movies, where it's like, you're not going to do anything. You're just going to stand there and let other people fight for you.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
I'm just saying it's not as impressive.
How dare you profane the Ninja Turtles in my presence?
I'm just saying, dude. All I'm saying is that if they had utilized, because they show him transforming into other people a couple times during the movie, and yeah, the effects aren't great, but it's almost as if they ran out of money at the end and they were like, well, we only have money for one more face switch, so let's do the really hackneyed, idiotic, change into Liu Kang's brother and try to convince him not to fight anymore gimmick instead of him. How cool would it have been if during that fight with Liu Kang, he was turning into Scorpion, he was turning into Sub-Zero, he was turning into the capoeira guy that Liu Kang fought in the sand, like, you know, and just
or the expected thing where, and you will have to fight yourself, where he has to fight himself.
They fucking set that up. They say face yourself to Liu Kang so many times, and that is an element of the game where if you play as any given character moving up that ladder, eventually you come across your own character and you do fight yourself. So that would have held true to the game.
I have a feeling that may have at some point, much like many of the effects in this movie, fallen prey to budgetary problems.
Very.
Where it's
very
like, oh, that's going to be too expensive and hard to do. Can we just have, I know what we can do. Fighting himself will be overcoming his fear. So he'll say, I'm not afraid of my destiny. And he fought himself.
Yeah.
Great. Awesome. Now we're not ripping off the Neverending Story.
Although he did turn
Neverending Story.
And he was Luke King's brother.
Okay, yeah. You know what? We haven't had a drinking moment in this episode
we
yet.
We haven't. You're going to say we should do the Neverending Story?
Why? Yes, why wouldn't we do the Neverending Story?
I was just thinking we should do Street Fighter, but yeah, maybe.
Yeah, let's do the good one.
Yeah, okay.
Neverending Story's now. Fucking awesome.
I mean, it is, but we're going to do Street Fighter 2 as well. Like, we're not doing Street Fighter 2. We will do Street Fighter as well. One of the things I do love a lot about Mortal Kombat is, as much as I enjoy the movie that it is, for all of its flaws, I love the movie that it is, I get giddy thinking about the movie that it almost was.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
The movie.
And you can hear it.
Fucking
you can
thing.
Hear it.
Oh, you absolutely can. Now, unsurprisingly, the first actor they approached to play Johnny Cage was Jean-Claude Van Damme. That makes the most sense ever.
The muscles from Brussels.
The inspiration for the game at the onset. But he declined because he was working on another film. Do you know what that film was?
I don't.
Yes, you do, because we've mentioned it during this show.
Well, no, I don't know what it was at the time.
No, we've just mentioned it literally seconds ago.
Street Fighter.
It was fucking Street Fighter. That is crazy to me that they offer Jean-Claude Van Damme the chance to play a lead role in a video game movie based on a video game based on him, and he says, no, I can't do this because I am doing a different video game. And he does Street Fighter instead. That is crazy to me.
And giving the second most unintelligible speech of all time.
Let me guess. The first one is Stallone in First Blood.
Yes!
Yes!
That is correct.
Nothing is over. It's like, okay.
And Colonel Trauma is just sitting there like, I can't make
heads or tails of like, if I have to listen to this for 5 more minutes, I'm going to pray for the original ending where they fucking shoot you. But yeah, so it was almost Van Damme. Then they don't get Van Damme. So who do they consider to replace him? Tom Cruise or Johnny Depp? In the mid-90s, folks. Odd choices. Okay, fine. Neither of them are available. Then, guess who was supposed to play fucking Sonya Blade? Sharon Stone was going to play Sonya Blade. But then she had to back out, so they bring in like a Miss Teen USA who gets injured on the set. So then they hire fucking Cameron Diaz. Cameron Diaz, who had just done her first fucking movie with Jim Carrey. But then she gets hurt on set.
And what's
set.
That first fucking movie with Jim Carrey?
Something called Mask about Rocky Dennis, I think. Anyway. But then she gets hurt on set, and that's why Brigitte Wilson-Sampras ends up with the role, who I think is really good in the role because she is ice cold. Like, she is harsh all the way around.
She's like, I'm not getting injured. I am not going to go home.
And she
I'm going to finish this fucking movie.
She did all of her own stunts, which is also doubly impressive. But that it doesn't stop there. It does not stop there. Do you know who
But
was,
wait, there's more.
Do you know who was originally offered Raiden? Sean Connery. Sean Connery turned down the part of Raiden.
Now, yeah. I mean, it was the 90s, and we were culturally insensitive as fuck. So why make, you know, an Asian god of thunder, you know, I don't know, maybe Asian.
So they got Christopher Lambert, who's French.
But you know
what? In a movie with Connery where he plays a Spaniard Scott, if I remember correctly. So
he's the Spaniard, yes.
I'm just saying, Sean Connery, not a stranger to playing races that are not, or nationalities that are not his own.
No. But Connery's famous for turning down stuff because the thing is, he just didn't understand it. Like, he turned down Lord of the Rings because he didn't fucking understand it.
This was after turning down The Matrix because he didn't fucking understand it.
This wouldn't be after.
No. What you said about Lord of the Rings would have been after The Matrix. But again, does not fucking stop there because the part of Liu Kang was originally going to be played by Brandon Lee. But Brandon Lee famously died on the set of The Crow, so they had to replace him. And then right down to the fact that, do you remember the scene where Johnny Cage is filming? By the way, Johnny Cage, JC, Jean-Claude, not hard to figure out.
Not much of a stretch.
Not a big stretch. And by the way, how does he defeat Goro? He doesn't just punch him in the balls. He does the splits.
He does the splits and punches him in the balls.
Anyway, remember he's making a movie within the movie to kind of show that he's an action star? Do you remember the director of that movie and how he looks painfully like Steven Spielberg?
Oh, yeah.
That's because Spielberg was supposed to have a cameo in the movie. So this movie was almost, guys, this movie was almost Sharon Stone, Brandon Lee, Jean-Claude Van Damme as the leads with fucking Sean Connery as Raiden.
I don't know, and almost a cameo, there.
And a cameo by Steven Spielberg.
In an alternate universe, that's what this movie is.
In an alternate universe.
A couple of those are almost.
In movies of future past, that is our Mortal Kombat. And to me, that is crazy awesome.
It's crazy pants.
And you know me, I love going down the rabbit hole to all these alternate versions of movies. And that one just kind of blows my mind a little bit. So that's the Mortal Kombat we almost got. And instead, we got a ripoff of Enter the Dragon with, and I will say, again, I want to hit on this, that the performances by Christopher Lambert and Kerry Hiroyuki Tagawa are so much better than this movie fucking deserves.
Oh, Christopher Lambert just seems happy to be there and is just having fun with the whole thing. Like, I'm playing a god. I don't actually do anything in the movie but walk around and quip at people and occasionally throw lightning around. But fuck it. And he seems to be having the time of his life.
Oh, absolutely. He cracks, like, in scenes that I think any other actor would, like, uphold the kind of aggrandized dialogue and the serious epic nature of the character, he'll just be like, haha, and walk away. Like, he's just like, he's like this little kid, you know, who got to put on a wig and play a big tough guy and just loves the hell out of it. And so, yeah, no, I have to give it up to that. And I think even the actor who plays Johnny Cage, Lyndon Ashby, is doing a pretty damn good job being sort of the American analog to Jean-Claude Van Damme, who in so many of his movies is professed to be the ultimate American, despite the fact that he's about as American as the fucking Eiffel Tower.
Yeah. You can hear in the dialogue, like, you could hear how it would sound.
He's so quippy. Oh my God. It. Johnny Cage is so quippy that you almost, like, I almost started doing accents every time he would say something like, oh, I wonder what the bathrooms are like. And it's like, yeah, I can hear it.
You can fucking hear it.
I can hear Van Damme delivering these lines.
Oh, I wish Van Damme had made this movie instead of Street Fighter.
I kind of don't.
I do.
I just love Street Fighter so much.
That's
a failing on my part. That, yeah, is a failing on my part as a human being.
I won't
being.
Bust your balls for it because I have worse being. Movies that I love. But oh God, is Street Fighter not an entertaining film?
So what is
And
your,
it's Raul Julia's last movie.
But again, much like Christopher Lambert or Tagawa in this film, he is fucking going for it.
Raul Julia is
going for it in Street Fighter, and I love what he does with that character because you just can't stop looking at him. And it's like, he's at the end of his life, he's battling horrible stomach cancer, and he's still just knocking shit out of the park. And that's how I feel about my favorite performers in this movie as well. So what is, Cargill, let me ask you this. What is your favorite element from the game that was brought into the movie in a creative way, if you haven't already mentioned it?
You know, I'd have to say the wonkiness of the sets, like the fact that they go out of their way to show a bunch of the background scenes from the game and give them like a physical locality, even though a lot of them just don't make any fucking sense. They're just there. And I think that's, I mean, it really does. This movie went all out to recreate the game and be as faithful to the game as possible. Although my favorite moment taken from the game is the Johnny Cage friendality.
Oh,
I mean, that's
yeah.
just my such a stupid, like, that moment makes no fucking sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
Like, it just doesn't. And is so patently cloying in trying to be fan service, and yet is so delightful at the same time when he just blows up Scorpion and then his picture falls to the ground from your best friend Johnny Cage. It's just like, oh, that's so stupid. I love it.
I think my favorite thing that it's creative in that the way they bring in the flawless victory that people say throughout the movie, it's creative in that half the time the people saying it don't seem to know what that means, and so the writer of the script doesn't appear to have ever really played the game, because he keeps, like, there are two times when someone says flawless victory when it's not at all.
No, because a flawless victory is what happens if you don't get hit.
In the video game, if your opponent never inflicts any damage upon you before you beat them entirely, flawless victory. It is said after, I think there's one, the fight where Goro kills the black guy that everyone's only met once, but is just so upset that he's dead.
They like him a lot.
Like, apparently so. He says flawless victory, even though that guy did definitely get some punches in on Goro. And it's also said by Liu Kang after he beat Shang Tsung, spoiler alert, even though they have beat the hell out of each other. And I'm like, guys, you keep using these words. I do not think it means what you think it means. But all in all, again, the single most entertaining of all of the video game movie adaptations. I think hands down. Like, and I'm somebody who really enjoys most of these terrible video game adaptations from the 90s. I'm a big fan of Street Fighter, big fan of Mortal Kombat. I even enjoy Super Mario Brothers to a certain extent.
Yeah, you do.
Most of that is Bob Hoskins. But yeah, this is the most entertaining of all of them. And I think a large portion of that is the energy of this movie. Like, there are so many moments where people are just, and I think its failings in story structure might actually help it a little bit, because it never lets up. It never lets you rest, because the minute one fight is over, you're in the next one. No setup, no, like, it just different venue, different people fighting each other. Just go. And it's like, press start and go. And the music just, like, underscores the whole thing with this pulsing, like, vibrant, it makes you want to get up and pose. And, like, if you've never done martial arts in your life, you're going to start throwing high kicks and posing, because the music just fucking makes you want
to
do
it. It is to fighting what Fast and the Furious is to driving.
Yes, absolutely. And which is funny, because one of the first people approached to direct this movie, Rob Cohn, who directed the Fast and the Furious. So that's an interesting comparison.
Finish him!
Which brings us to our junk food pairing for the week. And this one actually brought to you by Mr. Cargill, so I will let him set it up. Cargill, what is this week's junk
really,
food pairing?
There's really only one junk food pairing. That
there
you
can
really,
be only one.
There can be only one 10 years earlier. no. What the junk food pairing this week is this movie is pure entertainment. There's no substance. There's, you know, no attempt at bringing really anything together other than just having a good time. It was made for the youth. It is not good for you. It is not healthy, but it's fucking awesome. And that's why this week's junk food pairing is Jolt Cola. Best known for its slogan, twice the sugar and all the caffeine.
It is
the black can with a lightning bolt on it. It was a late 80s drink that went into the 90s, and it was so delicious and so bad for you. This is an era before we had energy drinks.
I was going to say, yeah, this does two things to kind of really tie in perfectly with this movie. One is, it is a lightning bolt to the fucking heart, as only Raiden could deliver, or possibly the soundtrack to Mortal Kombat. One Jolt Cola, and you think you can take on the entire universe all the other realms. And on top of that, it is also a precursor to what would come later in the big craze of energy drinks.
And which famously, Jolt would rebrand itself as an energy drink and then fold File Chapter 13 and fall apart. Yeah. The whole thing about Jolt was, it was a cola, and it was like Pepsi or Coke, but it was Pepsi or Coke for the extreme generation. Yes. For the video game playing, late night fucking VHS watching motherfuckers, my mom would go out and get me a six pack of goddamn Jolt, and I would be up all goddamn night and be bouncing off the goddamn walls.
So much is being explained.
It was so
coming into view.
Awesome. And this is the Jolt Cola of movies.
It is, because much like Jolt Cola and leading the way for what would become the renaissance of energy drinks, there is right now in Hollywood a renaissance of all of these projects of video games turned into movies. I mean, World of Warcraft is about to come out.
And they wrapped a couple months ago on Assassin's Creed, which actually shot on the same lot as several of the scenes of Strange.
Which I think is what's going to be really interesting, and something we've talked about in this episode, is now that we are basing these movies on games with a lot of story that are created by people who are kind of storytellers first and animators second, is that going to make for finally the curse of the... Because, once again, there has not been, and I will go on record as saying this, there has not been a legitimately good movie based on a video game ever made.
I agree.
There are a lot that are entertaining that we will talk about, but there has never been just an across-the-board, objectively quality movie based on a video game. And I'm wondering if we are about to see that for the first time because of what we've talked about on this show about the premises being so much more elaborate, the stories being so much more, having so much more depth. Are we finally going to see a movie, a good movie, based on a video game?
We will sometime soon. The studios finally have their heads wrapped around it. I know this from experience of working on Deus Ex. Everybody knows what they're looking for now. They figured it out. The video game companies are involved. The video game companies are very much about telling a story. And they understand the Tomb Raider problem, that a terrible movie can hurt your brand. Just as much as a terrible video game can hurt your brand. And that famous Tomb Raider argument that happened, you know, like 10 years ago over which one killed which. How about both of them sucked? I think we are finally in an era where we're going to, I don't know which one it's going to be. I have my fingers crossed that World of Warcraft is great. I've got my fingers crossed that Assassin's Creed is great. We'll see. I hope at least one of them is legitimately great. I hope both of them. I want to be doing junk food cinema circa 2030 and talking about both of those movies and the dawn of good video game movies and reference, hey, maybe you should go back in time and listen to our 20-year-old episode about Mortal Kombat.
That is, if the years of coffee and Jolt Cola haven't led to a...
early heart attack?
Fatality.
Probably going to happen.
Fatality.
Test your mic.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us for Mortal Kombat on Junk Food Cinema. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you'd like to hear more of our episodes, you can check out the back catalog on Stitcher as well as on iTunes. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
All right, you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or my page on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And I want to throw this out there to you guys. I want to get some feedback from you guys before we launch it, but make a just kind of a mini announcement here. Cargill and I have been flirting with the idea of launching a Patreon for Junk Food Cinema because we don't get paid for this at all. We just do this out of the love of doing it, which is awesome. But then the like light bill comes due and I'm like, but I'm passionate. And they're like, yeah, but you can't pay with that.
And
I'm
yeah.
Like,
no, and you take sucks. you put an awful lot of work into this.
It's not a small amount of
work. No. You put in like you do all the editing. I show up. I watch the movie with you, or I show up having watched the movie. We sit down. I have a cup of coffee or a beer or a couple beers and we talk about the movie. And then I go home and then you work for several hours. And I know how much work that is. So if we were to do something like that, this would be to supplement you and take care of your time so that you can afford to keep doing it.
Well, and I very much appreciate that. But what I want to throw out there to you listeners is that something you'd be interested in contributing to? One of the things I would like to do, if we get enough interest, is for people who subscribe, I would actually be recording some mini episodes to kind of reward you for your patronage, so you wouldn't be getting nothing for your money. I mean, it would allow this show to remain free, but on top of that, I would do some mini episodes that are just for you guys, the patrons. But if that's something you think you'd be interested in, tweet at us, respond to us on Facebook, and just let us know your thoughts on this, because we definitely want to make sure that we're doing what's best, not only for us, the creators, but for you guys, the listeners as well, because you're every bit as important, and we really appreciate you listening and supporting us. Go on iTunes, rank us, leave reviews. That stuff really helps. We appreciate it.
And just a small thing, keep your fingers crossed, but it looks like we may have, I won't say who yet, but we may have an interesting special guest next week.
Holy shit, that's right.
We're testing out having a guest on the show.
Yeah, we want to make that a regular thing. And if this first guest goes well, we had a guest long ago and far away, Dr. Landon Palmer, who was absolutely outstanding in breaking down Elvis movies for us. But we've gotten away from that for a very long time, and we are going to bring that back and make it a regular thing. And hopefully if the first guest of this new era is successful, It could lead to a lot of fun things, and I'm super excited about that. So lots to come for Junk Food Cinema. Stay tuned with us. And I can think of no better way to go out than, yeah, we're just going to play the song again. We're going to play the song again.
Mortal Kombat!